All right. All right. Then we're just going to get started. I've got beef jerky up here. For those who would like a piece, you'll have to go to the store to buy it. But I do. We do have notes available, so we're going to pass those down the aisle if you did not receive your notes for this session. I'm sorry? Oh, have you raised your hand? If you do not have your notes for this session, go ahead and raise your hand. Glad you're here. I'm Josh. I'm Dad's son. And mother's son as well. And we're not partial between mom and dad. Kind of like them both. They both have their pluses and minuses. And so, you know, it's not like I like one better than the other. I like mom and dad. And it's a balancing thing, you know. Growing up, there were times where I was tempted to like dad more and then tempted to like mom more. But I think I kept it pretty cool throughout the whole thing. And they still don't know which one I like better. So it's kind of something I want to keep going. And please help me with that. I will say strange things along the way. I know I will. For whoever brought this beef jerky, I really appreciate it. Golly gee, I'm thankful. I have to read the note. Please give the Custers an A for your class. And who are the Custers here? Where are we? Are you here? Hello, Brother Custer. Thank you so much for the beef jerky. You are a kind man. I'm not only a big beef jerky fan, but I'm also a big fan of cash. And so if you have any of that lying around, the home. How many of you like me, you like beef jerky? How many of you like me, you like cash? All right, so some of us. Hey, there he is. I kind of feel like I'm one of the politicians who comes to town and acts like he knows everybody. Hey. Have you ever seen them do this? And you're wondering who they're waving at? They're not waving at anybody. They're acting like they're important. And so I'm doing here tonight. We are going to be studying the book, The Five Love Languages, written by Gary Chapman. I don't really do a lot of teaching, original teaching, and the reason is because I'm too young to have come up with anything original. And so what I do is I kind of I do book reports, I suppose. And this is one that I've already done. I'm actually reading some new books in preparation for the coming years, looking forward to these. But this is one of my favorites. My wife and I have read this several times, had the opportunity of rereading through and dissecting this book once again. These are not the same notes that we taught through several years ago. I'd say about 3 years ago now. These are not the same notes. These are rewritten, and I wanted to take that opportunity so we can kind of look fresh at these once again, and that would be good. Now, the first session that we'll be going through, you're going to have fill in the blanks. We're not going to have PowerPoint that goes with it. Brother Joel, you come on up here for a minute. Brother Joel, I have my computer in here. This is my computer. Brother Joel at the Mac. Isn't that impressive? Yeah, there we go. Right on the desktop is the PowerPoint. It says five love languages. The way you open it. Okay. And if we can get it working, we can. If not, don't worry about it. We'll be all right. We'll make our way through. The subtitle of the book itself was How to Express Heartfelt Commitment to Your Mate. And the premise of the book is that each and every one of us have an opportunity, and we want to show love to our spouse. And we strive to show love to our spouse, but many times we come up empty. And the reason we do is because we may not be speaking the same language. Number one, we're going to look at this point. Number one, if the PowerPoint comes up, that's great. If it doesn't, don't you worry about it. We'll be all right. Number one, we see this. What happens to love after the wedding? Number one, we see this question. What happens to love after the wedding? That doesn't sound like a very romantic question to ask, but it is a valid question. And the reason it is a valid question is because I've been asked this question, and I know there are other pastors and teachers. I know many of you may have either asked this question or been asked this question. What happens to love after the wedding? I had an opportunity sitting in my office. It was probably not too long ago. And I had a young couple that I just came to our church. I had led his wife to Christ. He had just recently got saved. They were two single people in the church. Now, she was formerly married and she had several children. Him, this was his first. And they were just falling in love. And they would come and they would sit on the opposite sides of church until they found one another. And our church isn't that large. It's only, 250 to 300 people. And so very quickly they found one another. And eventually I began noticing that they were sitting together. And I thought this was kind of cute and sweet until I heard the word love. They were in love. And I thought, oh, my goodness. Well, first comes love. And then comes marriage. And oh, the baby carriage. Yeah, I always forget how that rhyme goes. And finally, I was surprised. We're not so surprised when I found out, sure enough, they wanted to get married. And so they sat me in my office and they said, Pastor, we're thinking about getting married. And I said, all right, well, let's talk about the variables in this and let's do a little counseling and this sort of thing. And we sure enough did. And they got married. And it was a beautiful wedding family there and this sort of thing. It wasn't, but probably about 8 to 9 weeks later, I could tell there was some tension in the home already. And this man came and he sat in my office and he said, Pastor, I need to talk with you. I said, well, what's wrong? And he said to me, he said, you know, I don't know how to say this. And I said, well, go ahead. Just tell me. What do you have to say? And he said, I just don't feel the same way I used to feel when we first were married. And I thought, first we're married. You got married 9 weeks ago, you know. And he said, I just don't feel the same the way we used to feel. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, I just don't feel like I love her like I used to. Boy, I got to tell you, I was a little shocked. I tried not to, show it on my face. I said, well, what do you mean? Tell me what you mean. And he said, well, the truth is, you know, I used to, every time she'd come in the room, I used to just get all excited about her. I don't get excited anymore. It used to seem like we had more time with one another, and then all of a sudden we don't seem to have as much time as we used to. And I just don't know what's wrong with the situation. And really the question was, where did the love go and what happened with the love relationship that we had? I think one of the problems that this man faced is a problem that a lot of us face in our marriage. We initially find out that when we first get married, hey, it kind of feels a little different than it did when we first met and we were dating. What's happening here? I want to point out a couple things. Number one, we see people speak different languages. Number one, we see that people speak different languages. People speak different languages. My wife and I, about 2 years ago, had a wonderful opportunity, very exciting opportunity. My wife and I took a trip across the big ocean, and we went over to visit Catalina Island, and it was very exciting. No, I'm just kidding. We went a little further than that. We went over the ocean. We went over to London and Paris, and interesting thing about London, they speak English over there, and the interesting thing about Paris, they don't. They speak a different language. And how many of you knew that? Okay, so I'm dealing with educated people here. All right, very good to know. And there in Paris, they're speaking French. And my wife, it was funny, she had tried her best to learn some French. She took French in high school. And so we were looking for the Eiffel Tower, you know. And I don't know how you cannot find the Eiffel Tower there in Paris. There it is, sticking up there, right there. And we're looking everywhere for it. And my wife, we got on the subway. We found where we were supposed to go. We got off the subway. Everything was written in French, kind of threw us. And we got off the subway and we began looking around. We knew it was around us somewhere, you know. We knew that was the station where it was, but we couldn't find it. And so my wife walked up to one of the street vendors and she said to the street vendor in French, she said, where is the Eiffel Tower? And the street vendor looked at her like this. And she said again in her French that she had learned, she said, where is the Eiffel Tower? And the street vendor said, I have no idea. I just said, ask him where the Eiffel Tower is. He said, oh, you speak English. The Eiffel Tower is right around the corner down this way. well, sure. Of course you speak English. My wife was a little embarrassed. She didn't try her French for quite a while after that. People speak different languages. And when we do speak different languages, there's some confusion that can happen right along the way. The confusion that we find. Am I able to just pick this up and go? I can just do it myself. Oh, I have it right here. Oh, I'm very high tech here. Oh, just press the button. Wow. Hey. Oh, this is fantastic. Now, how many of you think this is just too small? You can't read it anyway. Okay. So it just doesn't matter. But for those of you who can't. Oh, there's. Wow. Look at all the TVs. They didn't have the TVs back when I was here. This is great. Getting high tech, aren't we? All right, let's move on. So number two, One of the things we know this to be true, we feel the most comfortable speaking the language of our, we feel most comfortable speaking our native language. We feel most comfortable speaking our native language. How many in this room speak two different languages? You speak English, Spanish, French, whatever it might be. You speak two different languages. Raise your hand. All right. Very good. How many of you are trilingual? You speak at least three different languages. You speak three. Anybody here? Do you really? What languages do you speak? And I can't even say those three, really. Very good. And in the back as well. What languages do you speak? Yes, ma'am. Amazing. See, and I only speak. How many of you are just unolingual like me? And all right. You know what they call somebody who speaks three languages trilingual. Somebody who speaks two languages bilingual. You know what they call somebody who speaks one language? They call them American. That's what they call them. Only speak one language. And so people speak different languages, and we feel most comfortable speaking our native tongue. And that's true. Whatever you grew up using, you probably feel most comfortable in speaking. If you grew up speaking English or Spanish or whatever it might be, that's what you probably feel most comfortable speaking. Dr. Gary Chapman, who wrote the book, he said this: we must be willing to learn our spouse's primary love language if we're able to effectively communicate our love. His thesis is this. His thesis is number three. We must learn the secondary language, the one that our spouse speaks. So we're going to look at five different languages in which a person expresses their love to somebody, not their verbal communication, but the way they express their emotional feelings for somebody. And we're going to see that the way one person may express their love to another is not necessarily the same way that person may want to express their love back to the other individual. And one of the problems that we have is we speak different languages. If we only speak our native language and never learn our spouses, all love will be lost. And this, I believe, is the cause for some divorces that we see today. If we only speak our native language and we never choose to learn to speak the language of our spouse, then all love will be lost. I know a couple dear friends of ours, and one, their native language is Spanish. The other is a completely different language altogether. And one is from Samoa, and I'm not sure what they speak. Samoan? Okay, there you go. And so one speaks Spanish, one speaks Samoan. And before they were married, they both didn't speak English that well, but they fell in love. And true enough, love brought them together, and they got married. And before you knew it, one would not necessarily learn the language of Spanish, and the other wouldn't learn the language of Samoan. They had to learn English together, and that was the way they communicated. Let me ask you this question. How long do you think that relationship would have lasted if one just stood firm and said, no, you've got to learn my love. You've got to learn my language. You've got to learn Spanish. And if the lady said, no, you've got to learn Samoan, that's the way it's going to be. Well, most likely that family wouldn't have worked very well. And the reason is you must communicate. Titus chapter 2, verse 4 says this, that they may teach the young women to be sober and to love their husbands and to love their children. Somebody might say this, Pastor Tice or Josh here. Somebody might say, why is it that we have this idea of the fact that we have to learn how to show our love to our spouse? Shouldn't it be that we just naturally show our love? Maybe a lady in this room is thinking, it's not really romantic for us to sit in some sort of a session where my husband has to learn how to tell me he loves me. I think what should happen is that he just naturally shows me that he loves me. And the reason we may think that is because we've watched one too many movies. And the reason we may think that is because we've watched one too many television shows, or maybe the soap operas, or maybe those little books that have people kissing on the front. And maybe that's the reason why we think that. And the truth is this, to love somebody, you've got to learn how to love that person. That's what this passage in the Bible teaches us in Titus chapter 2, that we do have to learn how to love somebody. So number two, let's talk about this idea before we get into the love languages themselves. Let's talk about the idea of keeping the love tank full. The idea of keeping the love tank full. Now, how many of you know what the feeling is when you're driving down the road and you run out of gas? How many of you have ever felt that feeling before? Raise your hand. That is not a good feeling. Have you been there? You're driving down the road and all of a sudden you hear something first. And you're thinking, oh, Lord, help me, please, to get to a gas station soon. That's the idea. And you want to get to the gas station. You hope you get there. And it's not a good feeling because after the sound starts, the feelings of the car kind of chugging. and you're just hoping that you hit a road of a patch of road that you're kind of going downhill, and then eventually the car stops and you're stranded, and then you're hoping you charged your cell phone because you need a ride, you see, and so that's a difficult thing. So it's a difficult feeling, and it's a horrible feeling when your emotional love tank draws empty as well. Number one, we learned that marriage is designed to meet the greatest need of all. The greatest need of all is love. Marriage is designed to meet the greatest need of all. The greatest need of all is love. And just as much as your car needs a tank of gas, so your heart needs a tank of love. You need to have that feeling of love. The man who came to me and said, I don't have the same feelings that I used to have. I don't have the same love. I don't feel like I'm in love anymore. What's the problem there? One of the primary problems is that the love tank that he has there, his love tank is not full. It's running on empty, and he's afraid that things are going to fail very soon. Genesis chapter 2, verse 18 says, "The Lord God said, it is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a help that is meet for him." You see, Adam had something with the animals. He had a relationship. He had pets, you know. And he named all the pets, and he enjoyed getting to know them. But there was something that they could not provide for him. And by the way, it was also something that God could not provide for him. The Bible said he needed somebody else. He needed somebody to show him the love that only a spouse could. So God created him a help that was meet or suitable for him. And so we see that this is a need. The love that you crave from your spouse is a great need. Number two, we see the danger of an empty tank. The danger of an empty tank. The danger of running out of gas, or the danger of an empty tank, is the fact that you'll never know when you've completely run out until you stop. Somebody might be in this room right now and you say, well, quite frankly, I think I'm pretty good. I mean, things aren't as good as they used to be, but I'm not completely out of love yet. Have you ever been driving down the road and you see it get to E? You know, you're sitting there, it's at E, and you're thinking, I just don't have the money to fill it up, or I don't have the time to fill it up right now, but I'm pretty sure I got 10 miles on this thing. And you just keep going. By the way, everybody who raised their hand earlier that said that they know what it's like to run out of gas, I know you've thought those thoughts, because you wouldn't have run out of gas if you didn't. And so there you are, you're driving around, and you see the needle, it's kind of bouncing right there on E, and you're thinking, I know I can make it. I'm just going to go a little bit further. And all of a sudden, you never know when it's going to happen, but you're done. You're out. It's gone. You're out of gas. This is the way I believe your emotional love tank happens as well, or goes out of gas as well. You run out where you may feel like and know that very soon you could be in a dangerous situation with your relationship, but you're never quite sure when it's actually going to stop. And the reason you don't know is because you're not completely quite sure where your love tank is, and you're definitely not sure where your spouse's love tank is. And all of a sudden, marriages will break up like this, and people will ask, well, did you see this coming? Well, sure, I saw there were problems, but I didn't know it was going to happen this quickly. I didn't know that this was going to happen. Why? Because there's a great danger in running in an empty tank. The empty tank can run out at any time. And, boy, I'll tell you, I was had an opportunity. I was sitting across from a man who sat with me. Actually, it happened like this. And this is the way it normally happens. I get a phone call. And it was from a very distraught woman. She's crying on the phone. In my type of personality, I usually always constantly tell myself, well, it's not as bad as it sounds, you know. And sometimes it is as bad as it sounds. And I got this phone call, and she's crying on the phone. I said, well, what's wrong? As a church member, she said, things are horrible. And she said, my husband, he doesn't love me anymore. We're getting a divorce. Now, I've heard that before, and, you know, sometimes people are serious, sometimes they're not. I said, well, things are going to be okay. Let's just talk about this. Come on into the office. We'll have a talk. No, Pastor, I don't think he's going to do it. He doesn't want to at all. I said, oh, come on. Just tell him to come in the office. We'll be all right. And sure enough, we set up a time for them to come in, and she was the only one who showed up. So I kind of had her tell the story. She told me kind of what's been going on. I said, don't worry about it. I'll contact him, and I'll talk to him about the situation. And I did that. I contacted him. He said, well, I really don't want to talk about it. I said, well, why not? He said, well, I'm done. I said, what do you mean you're done? He said, I'm done. He said, I've just been living in this mess too long, and I'm done. I said, we got to meet. He said, okay. So I finally met with him, and I had an opportunity of looking at him from eye to eye. If you've ever had an opportunity of looking at somebody who is done with marriage, they're done. You can see it in their eye. They've been fighting the battle long enough, and they just want to give up. I mean, there's nothing you can say to talk this person, and they're done. And I remember looking at this guy, and I remember saying, well, what do you mean you're done? I'm not here to talk you into getting back together. I'm here to find out what you're thinking about. What are your thoughts? How about your walk with God? He said, I'm done. I said, what made you get to this point? He said this. He said, it was just been so many years of screaming, of criticism, of anger, of frustration. And he said, I just got to the point where I was done. Now what happened there? I think and by the way, this person had for several years going to church, serving the Lord, on his way. They're both, the whole family's doing fine. But then all of a sudden, done. Why? Because he himself didn't realize how low his emotional love tank had gotten. And it got to the point where he just ran out and he was completely done. Number three, we see that people behave differently when their love tanks are full. People behave differently when their love tanks are full. I wish you could meet some folks at our church. Their names are Gary and Judy Burns. They're very sweet, dear friends of mine and my wife's. They're in their late 50s, and I think they may even be in their early 60s. They are, because they're both retired. They're probably 63, 64, 65, something like that. And they've retired out here in Vegas. They've got family here in Vegas, and they're sweet. We love them to death. My wife and I will get together. But my wife and I always laugh after we're together with them. We just talk about it and kind of giggle about their relationship. And the reason we do is because we've met a lot of couples. Some are cantankerous and funny, and then some are just, they kind of nitpick and fight about things. And then others are just, this couple is just funny, because every time we're together with them, it's like they're dating. Now, this is humorous to me, and the reason it's only humorous to me is because I'm 28 years old. And here are these people in their mid-60s or early 60s, and they're just absolutely head over heels. I mean, it's really silly. It really is. Now, I'm not talking that they're, you know, hiding behind the couch kissing whenever we're not looking. All right, this is not what I'm talking about. But I'm every time they sit together, they hold hands, you know. And every time they're talking, he looks over and says, oh, she's so funny. And he'll pat her leg like this. And she'll say, oh, I've got to tell you a story about Gary. And she'll tell this story about him, and always making him sound so lovable and so likable. And my wife and I always walk away having this physical sermon in front of us of what a relationship really ought to be like. Have you ever known somebody like that? You say, well, how exactly did they get the relationship to that point? I don't think it's that they have never had a bad time. In fact, my wife and I asked them, listen, you know, we deal with a lot of families. How is it that your relationship is so vibrant and you've been married for so many years? And they told us this. They said, well, the truth is we just keep showing love to one another. And they said this. It's not that we didn't have bad times. There were tough times. But we just kept showing love to one another. That's what it means to keep filling the love tank. Let's look at number three. Number three, falling in love. Now, the reason I want to talk about falling in love before we actually get to the love languages themselves is because I believe there's this mythical idea and misunderstanding of what falling in love really is all about. When you're 6, 7 years old, you begin to be told by television and by friends and by others that one day you're going to get married. And so a logical young little boy or little girl begins looking around for people to get married to. In fact, if you ask a lot of little children at that age who they're going to marry, they're going to pick either mom or dad or one of the siblings. Currently, right now, my son's going to marry Savannah. That's the plan. They're going to grow up and get married, and they play house. But eventually, they turn about 11 and 12, and that idea isn't as appetizing. And then I think that that's a good idea. Then they begin looking around and noticing the opposite sex and thinking about getting married. And these thoughts are natural. And then it happens. Then your child, for the very first time, falls in love, you know. You know, it's that queasy feeling down inside your tummy. And you see that person walk in the room and you just can't breathe. And your arms begin to get really sweaty underneath. And that person walks to you and your mouth turns all dry. And you say, somebody said maybe you're having a heart attack. I don't know. It could be. That'd be a pretty unhealthy 11-year-old, I'll tell you that. So this boy is, man, he's falling in love, and he comes and he talks about how he really likes this girl and this girl really likes her, and they're going to go out or they're going to go steady, and this is falling in love. And then there are people in the 30s that are just shockingly ignorant in this area of falling in love, because they're looking for the 11-year-old experience when they're in their 30s. Falling in love is something we really truly need to understand. Number one, by nature, we need to understand we are egocentric. This is what my father calls, you are a selfish, self-centered, maniacal, crazy person who only loves yourself. This is the way my father expressed it. And how many of you just can be honest with yourself and know that that's true? Yeah, absolutely. Man, we are. We want what we want, and we want what we want. We want it now. What's interesting about the in-love experience, the in-love experience is this. It's the euphoria of falling in love. This in-love experience gives us the illusion that we are genuinely altruistic. We are genuinely caring about the needs of others. So you're 13, 14 years old, and you see that person, and you think, well, I just want to make that person happy. So you forget about what you want to do. You forget about the video game or the television show you want to watch. And it's Valentine's Day. So what you do is you take your time and you go and find a big piece of red paper, you know, construction paper. And you get your scissors out and you make a big heart. And then you glue stuff on that. Why are you doing this? Because you feel like you are genuinely altruistic. You want to do something for this person because you are in love with this person. And that's true. That in-love experience makes you not as concerned about what your needs are, but you are truly, genuinely concerned about the needs of others. Number two, let's talk about the fading of infatuation. I think the idea of the in-love experience really can be classified with this word, infatuation. Infatuation. Is that little boy truly in love? Well, more likely he's infatuated. He's infatuated. That's what we call the honeymoon experience, you know? Talk about that. Well, one of these days. Have you ever heard a very cynical, I can remember my wife and I when we first got married. I'm telling you, boy, we had not only the in-love experience, we were in love. I mean, we were in love. And when we first got married, I can remember sitting around a little family get-together with Heather's family. And one of her brothers, and he was, they're about 12, 15 years older than her. One of her brothers looked down and said, well, that's going to change eventually. And I looked over, I said, what? Oh, y'all just holding hands and being this close together. That's going to change. You're just in the honeymoon period. And I thought, dear God, save me from that guy, you know. Oh, man, I don't want my love. You know, and I see him, and they're, you know, always in separate rooms, let alone sitting on the same couch. And I thought, boy, I don't want that in my life. Not at all. But there is genuinely this idea of the honeymoon experience. Well, what is the honeymoon experience? Now, the idea of love doesn't have to change after 2 years, but there is something that happens within that 2 years that does change in the marriage relationship. What changes is the fact that you go from being primarily concerned about the needs of that other person to primarily concerned about the needs of yourself. The honeymoon experience could last for 24 hours or it could last for 2 years, but one way or another, it will end. It's that idea of I want to do whatever this person wants with me and for me. And I just, what do you want, honey? No, I don't care. What do you want to do? Okay. No, you. No, you're cuter. I love you more. You see. You go back and forth. That changes. And it changes to things like, I want a new car. What you don't understand, honey, is that I work really hard. I spend my days working and I want a new car. But the children need braces. Listen, when they want they can buy them themselves. I'm not kidding. I want a new car, you know. He goes to things like, I want to go out to dinner. Okay, let's go out to dinner. All right, we're going to have special. We're going to go out to dinner. This is where I want to go. And then we begin to express our will. Now, that doesn't happen early on. That happens whenever the in-love experience begins to fall away. I want to visit my family for vacation. I do not want to visit your family for vacation. You know. I want to join the softball league. Well, we don't have enough time as a family, but I want to join. But I want you here, and I want you to help clean. It goes from what can I do for you then to what you can do for me. It goes from, I want to serve you because I feel this feeling of infatuation and love, to, you haven't been serving me the way I want you to serve me, and I better start soon. And that's why those who never mature in this area of love will bounce from one relationship to another relationship to another relationship to another, because they feel like the in-love experience is the end of the road. And once that in-love experience is over, then there's really nothing to live for. The relationship is over. And they fooled themselves into thinking that there are some people that just have this in-love experience the rest of their life. Let me tell you about Gary and Judy Burns that I talked about a moment ago. They don't have the in-love experience. They just love one another. There's a difference. The in-love experience of infatuation eventually will fade. But truly loving one another will always bring joy, happiness, peace, security, and a great sense of being loved. Now, I want to express this idea as we go forward here. The Bible says in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 29, it says, "For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth it and cherisheth it." The Bible says we do love ourselves. And so we talked about that just a moment ago. And it really is sad if love is based on what you can do for me. Now, I want you to think about this before we move on to number three. It really is sad if somebody's relationship is based upon how you make me feel, what you can do for me, then it really is quite a shallow relationship. What do you mean? I believe this. I believe that true love is a rational, volitional, intentional love. True love. Now, true love would be the opposite of the in-love experience. You know, your 14-year-old comes to me and says, "I just can't stop thinking about her." Okay, your 14-year-old is in infatuation, the in-love experience. That's not true love. It's what we call puppy love. They're infatuated because that's the moment that they're in. This is a rational, volitional, intentional love. Another way to say that is love is a choice. Let's walk through those. Rational. Rational means there's a logical explanation why I am loving this person. Volitional, that means it's a determination of the will. I will love this person. Intentional means it's not by accident. I am purposely loving this person. Now, when I first met Heather, it was not rational, it was not volitional, and it was not intentional. When I saw Heather walk by, I didn't rationally say, "I'm going to love that person." I said, "Oh, my word." It wasn't non-intentional. It wasn't intentional. I didn't say, "Okay, I've got to pick somebody. You'll do." Okay, that's not how it happened. It was unintentional. I just wow, you know, when you fall in love, it's just unintentional. You don't mean it for it to happen. It just does. But true love is intentional. Let me give it to you this way by an illustration. I have a dear friend. His name is Ken. Ken lost his wife about a year ago, this March. Next month will be 1 year. And they had been married for 46 years. Isn't that wonderful when you hear that? Well, I hope some of you young couples strive for goals like that. What a good thing. 46 years they had been married, and he lost his wife. She had gotten very sick. She had diabetes, and then she had a stroke. And when she had a stroke, she never really recovered from the stroke. She partially did, brought her home for a little bit. Eventually, she had to go into hospice. And boy, what a mess that is. And we'd go in and visit Susan on a regular basis and pray with her and read her the Bible. And it was during the primaries last year. And she was a big political junkie, man. She was a big Ronald Reagan fan. And so anybody that didn't fit the Ronald Reagan profile, she was against. And so she would look up on the screen and she would pick out, "I don't like this guy." And so we'd just sit there and laugh and watch television together. And she enjoyed that. But eventually she got to the point where she was really unable to speak. She got to the point where she really wasn't able to communicate at all. And she went probably about 8 to 9 weeks where she was almost in a comatose state before she passed. Now, if you've ever lived through something like that, you realize there's no way to know when the person will actually pass. It could be tomorrow. It could be a year from now. And so emotionally, it's extremely draining on the person that loves that person the most. And I watched Ken walk through this situation with such grace. But more than the word grace that comes to mind is the word love. Oh boy, I thought I understood love before this. I didn't understand what love was. Every day, he'd wake up. He would drive down to the hospice care. He would sit in that little room as nurses walked by and many times ignored the needs of the patient inside, and he would just sit there and try to work her legs. He would take her arms and he would sit her up and work her arms. She couldn't even speak at this point. I would come in and see him. I said, "How you doing, Ken? How long you been here?" He said, "Well, I've been here about 9 or 10 hours. I said, "You doing all right?" He said, "I'm doing fine." There were several times I walked outside of the room with him. He would never break down, even whenever she was in a comatose state. He would never cry in front of her. But we would walk outside, and I put my arm around him, and then he would just begin to weep. And his big shoulders, much, much bigger than me, big shoulders would just come up and down, and he would cry. He said, "Pastor, I miss her so much." Friend, that's what love is. And these good-for-nothing jokers who have no idea what love is, that jump from one relationship to another relationship to another relationship, finding until the moment that they just don't feel the tingle anymore, they'll never understand love. People like Hugh Hefner will never understand love. I don't say that with a joke. That's not a joke. Don't smile. Hugh Hefner will never understand love. Because his entire life, when the feeling's gone, he jumps. I feel bad for people like that, don't you? Listen, you can have real love, true love, the love that God intended you to have, as long as we understand that the love that we're speaking of is not the falling in love experience. So number four here, we see this, maturity. What is maturity? Maturity is moving from puppy love to true love. Maturity is moving from puppy love to true love. I like what Philippians says. The book of Philippians, Paul said to the church, he said, "Fulfill ye my joy and be ye like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness and of mind, let each esteem other better than themselves. Look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others." Now, he just gave the definition of love. He said love is finding out what the other needs and doing the things of the other. See, Ken didn't sit there and say, "Well, my goodness, all I ever do is take care of this woman. She doesn't do anything for me." He wasn't thinking that way at all. He loved her. So it didn't matter how long this process took. He was going to take care of her. That's true love, you see. You know, and that's what makes it really sick when somebody walks into your office weeks later and says, "Well, I just don't love my wife anymore." And I think, Fred, you have no idea, friend, what love is all about. You don't know love, you see. And so here we see verse 5, it says, look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who truly loved us. Let this mind be in you, who is also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of man. Being in found fashion as man, he humbled himself, became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. You see, love is serving someone else. This is the idea of love. And so we need to understand love before we go into this. Now, somebody might say, "Well, Pastor Tice, if that person really loved me, they would learn my love language." No. If you really love them, then you're going to learn their love language and how they're trying to communicate to you. This is the premise, and I don't have a clock. Do I? Do I have a clock around here? 10 minutes. All right, we can do that. The premise or the thesis of the book is this. The thesis of the idea is this, is that we are different people with different personalities. And being different, we have to learn things about our spouse. And sometimes we have to learn how to communicate love to the person that is apart from us or the person that we're married to. We may even feel like we're trying to express love, but they're not receiving love because it's all coming in a different love language. So let's look at all five of the love languages for the next 10 minutes, and then we'll take the next hour, of course, as well, and we'll conclude. That's right, tonight's schedule? We do both of these, and then we conclude. All right, let's go ahead and look at love language number one. Love language number one, we call that words of affirmation. Love language number one, words of affirmation. Mark Twain said this, "I can live for 2 months on a good compliment." I like Mark Twain, great writer. He said, "You know, I could live for 2 months on a good compliment." How many of you ever felt that way? Well, I'll tell you, somebody comes to you and just says, boy, you're doing a good job. I got to tell you, I hope I never get a big head, and I hope I'm not a prideful person, but I love it. I'm going to just be open. I hope you don't, I'm not offended by this. I love it after the end of church service, somebody will come by, shake my hand, and they'll say, preacher, that was a good message. Now, sometimes I know people are just saying that, and it really wasn't that good because I can tell, you know, I preached for an hour and a half. I really didn't say anything at all. Everybody fell asleep. Somebody comes by and says, that was a good message. I'm thinking, yeah, thanks. It's not true. But, well, you know, when I feel it's all right, it was okay. It was par. And somebody comes by and they say, Pastor Ty, that was a good, Josh, Pastor Josh, that was a good message. I say, well, you say, oh, you're prideful. No, I'm not prideful. I just enjoy people telling me that I've done well. See, it's okay to be enjoy the fact that people tell you if you've done something well. It's not prideful. It's just that you're enjoying words of affirmation. I don't like it when people tell me what a jerk I am. But I do like it when people tell me what a great guy I am. Oh, that's just vanity. Come on. Come on. Be real with yourself. It's not vanity. It's just the truth. The Bible says death and life are in the power of the tongue, and they that love it, that is, love the understanding of the tongue, they that love it shall eat the fruit thereof. Now, notice this. This is a really good verse. Death and life are in the power of your words. And those who love this principle, those who learn this principle, the Bible says will eat the fruit of it. That means if you learn how to use your tongue wisely, you can live your life based upon the words you say. You will advance your career based upon the words you can learn to say. You will advance your relationship based upon your tongue and how you speak. How many of you learned that to be true in life? The Bible says in Proverbs chapter 12, verse 25, heaviness in the heart of a man maketh it stoop, but a good word maketh it glad. Have you ever gone to somebody and you just could tell that they were down? And you walked up and you said, hey, guy, how you doing? I'm not good. Well, I got to tell you, you know, the truth is, I saw what you did last week, and I heard about what this happened. And I got to tell you, I respect you so much. And I'm so thankful for you. I love you so much. You know, you can almost physically see that person's attitude change. Have you ever done this with a child? Child's really discouraged or pregnant, kicking. And walking around, and you say, hey, guy, what's the matter? Hey, sweetie, what's wrong? Oh, and they begin telling you what's wrong. And you look down and you say, oh, you know what? Daddy loves you so much. And you can see their physical. Why? Because there's power in that. And we need to learn that power. And here's some good ideas. Here's some good ways to do it. You can say to somebody, hey, you look sharp in that suit. That's not a bad thing to say. Here's a good one that you can tell your wife. Do you look great in that dress. Do you ever look nice? Wow. I have never seen you look so good. Woo! My goodness, I don't think I'll be able to leave the room. You're just beautiful. Wow! And you say, well, I don't want to go overboard. Go overboard. Go overboard. It's all right. They're not going to mind. Go overboard. Tell them how great they look. Hey, listen, that's a whole lot better than somebody starving for a compliment, right? Boy, I'll tell you, I've met people that are just starving for somebody to tell them good, something good. Just waiting to hear it. By the way, that's how affairs start many times. Some guy who doesn't really mean to step into it, he just talks a lot. He looks at somebody and says, boy, you look nice today. She hasn't heard that in years, and she begins to feel love toward him because she had words of affirmation. And her husband's ignored her for years. And so here we see this idea of words of affirmation. Here's some other things you could say. Well, we don't have time. All right, let's go on. Let's go on. Let me give this illustration. This illustration was given in the book, and I stay away from a lot of the illustration in the book for a reason, because I want to give my own, but also I want you to pick up the book and read it yourself. It's a very good read. It'll be a very good help. But here's an illustration that was given in the book. There was a woman that came into counseling, and the woman came and she said, Dr. Chapman, I've been working so hard at trying to get my husband to paint the bedroom, and he won't paint the bedroom. I mean, I tell him every single day, why don't you paint the bedroom? Well, you're lazy. All you ever do is do silly things around here. You need to paint the bedroom. She said, in fact, just the other day, I saw him outside. It was a beautiful day, sunny day, nice and cool. And there he was outside. He was, you know what he was doing? He was waxing his car. She said, well, you know what I did? I walked right up to him and I said, what are you doing out here waxing your car? You need to get inside, change into your painting clothes and paint the bedroom. And she said to him, she said, I've been trying so hard to get him painted bedroom, and he hasn't painted the bedroom. He said, well, that's too bad. I'm sorry to hear that. She said, do you have any advice? He said, I think I do. He said, I think the way you ought to do it is this. I think what you ought to do is two things. Number one, he said this. Next time, he asked this question. Does your husband ever know? He asked this question. He said, does your husband know that you want him to paint the bedroom? And she said, I think he does. He says, okay, all right. Then let me ask you another question. Does your husband do other things that are helpful around the house? She said, well, yeah, there's some things, but he hasn't painted the bedroom. She said, okay. He said, okay. He said, here's two suggestions. Number one, I don't want you to ever mention the bedroom again. Never mention the bedroom again. And secondly, the next time you see him doing something around the house, compliment him for doing so. And he said, I guarantee you what'll happen is he'll paint the bedroom. She said, I don't think that'll work, you know. This is what we're convinced. We've convinced ourselves that if we push hard enough, somebody's going to do something. That's why we get on the phone with the insurance company, and we're going to make somebody hear our voice. And we'll stay on hold for hours. You know, we're going to make somebody hear our voice. And why? We say, oh, something's going to happen. The greasy wheel gets the something or a squeak. And it's a phrase, I don't know. And so here we see. Well, you know what happened? Eventually she goes and he paints the bedroom. Why? Because she used her words correctly. Criticism will never, never, never lead. Criticism will never lead to change. I like what Dr. Paul Chappell says. Dr. Chappell, he's preached here a couple times. He said this, acceptance is the optimal environment for change. Acceptance is the optimal environment for change. Maybe deep down, here, husbands, wives, maybe deep down, and I might touch on some touchy issues here. That's all right. Keep listening. Maybe deep down, you're thinking of your spouse. Boy, it could be nice if they lost a little weight. I'm not trying to touch on toes. I'm just trying to help you with an illustration. You're thinking, boy, it'd be nice if they lost a little weight. And this is the way a wife will normally go about it.
You need to lose some weight.
This is the way a husband might go around it. Things are starting to get tight. Maybe you need to lose some weight. All right. The optimal environment for change is not criticism, it's acceptance. It really is. It's to go to that person and say, you know what, I love you so much. You're so beautiful to me. Say, oh, that doesn't seem like that'll help. Friend, it does. It works. Let me prove this to you. Let's go on. Actually, what are we at? All right, we're going to take a break. And we'll be back here in 5.